that's about it for me. I'm Dave Herman with the Rock and Roll Afternoon Show, The Summer of Love, 1967. And, of course, 1967 radio in New York wouldn't be what it is without Jonathan Schwartz. Jonathan is next as the beat goes on here at 92.3 K-Rock. Stay tuned.
The beat goes on. The beat goes on. Drums keep pounding a rhythm to the brain. La-da-da-da-dee. La-da-da-da-da. Charleston was once the rage, uh-huh. Goes on, the beat goes on. Drums keep pounding a rhythm to the brain. La da 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 dee, la da 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 da. And the beat goes on.
Yes, the beat goes on.
And the beat goes on.
And the beat goes on.
Goes on.
Summer of Love Station, 92.3 K-Rock, in stereo, WXRK, New York.
Jonathan Schwartz with you this hot Thursday evening in this most interesting summer, isn't it? In 1967. It's just interesting. I don't know, the undercurrent is far more dangerous than we've experienced in recent years. Edward Brown has a lot to say, as usual, about undercurrent, and he'll be here in a minute or so. And as usual, every night before the sobriety of Edward Brown, I like to take a look at Major League Baseball. I don't intend to be frivolous in any way. It's just there's a kind of comic juxtaposition to my look at baseball and the severity of Ed Brown. But as we stand on this Thursday evening, do you realize that the New York Metropolitans have won only 5 games less than the Yankees? And they're into their 5th year here. Only 5 games, and it's the 13th of August. Which augurs well down the line, doesn't it? Look at the Cardinals. They've won 70 games already. That remarkable Bob Gibson. They're likely to win that National League race. They have an 8.5-game lead over Atlanta. As for the American League, who knows? Look at them. The White Sox and Minnesota both have won 61 games. The Tigers, 61 as well. The Red Sox, 60. And the California Angels, 61. The Red Sox are the big surprise at 60 and 52. But, of course, there's a long way to go. between the 13th of August and the end of the year. Although, and I don't even know how this applies, but I'll just throw it at you for what it's worth. It was on this day in 1951 that the New York Giants began their ascension, their incredible comeback that led to the three-game playoff against the Dodgers and the eventual Bobby Thompson home run. It was on the 13th of August. They were 13 and a half games out on the 13th of August, 1951. They went on to lose the World Series to the Yankees in six games, but they were very competitive. I mean, in other words, they nearly won the World Championship as a result of what they began on August 13th, 1951, 16 years ago. 92.3 K-Rock, Jonathan Schwartz on this Thursday evening, and as usual, at 7 o'clock, commentary from Edward Brown.
10 days ago, President Johnson announced that he was sending another 50,000 men to Vietnam. There are more than 400,000 there now. Just yesterday, the White House acknowledged that the list of North Vietnamese targets had grown larger, while in Congress, arguments about war powers have grown louder, and in the streets, protests against the war have grown more frequent and more violent. There is a lot of talk about the need to talk, but the United States and Hanoi have set terms for talks that neither can or will accept. With the Gulf of Tonkin resolution in his pocket, President Johnson is disinclined to talk to anyone who might talk back. And increasingly, public dissent on many issues is of a type that does not produce dialogue or even want it. It is communication by threat and demand, through chant and bullhorn, printed T-shirts and bumper stickers. Consider how much of the history of this decade can be compressed to that size. Segregation, today, tomorrow, forever. George Wallace, 1962. George Wallace is Rosemary's Baby, a picket sign, same year. One of the more recent slogans is remarkable in the way it dismisses all complexity. Never trust anyone over 30. Some rallying cries make detail unnecessary. Freedom now. The most sparing of declarations are sometimes big enough to speak for generations of unheard voices. I've got to march. Martin Luther King Jr., Selma, Alabama, 1965. A one-liner of 1963 on the newswire shouted, UPI flash, President Kennedy dead. That led Robert Kennedy to say in 1964, an assassin never changed the course of history. He was wrong. The entire political campaign of 1964 can be reviewed through this one-line thought process. When Barry Goldwater said extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice, alarm bells clanged everywhere. So the GOP rushed out with, in your heart, you know he's right. But after Goldwater allowed how tempting the idea was to toss a bomb into the men's room at the Kremlin, the Democrats carried the day with, in your heart, you know he might. And that's how Lyndon Johnson became the peace candidate. We are not going to send American boys 9 or 10,000 miles from home to do what Asian boys ought to be doing for themselves. LBJ, 1964. Within a year of the Johnson landslide victory and the escalating buildup in Vietnam, the one-liner sweeping the country was, I was told if I voted for Goldwater, we would be at war in 6 months. I did, and we were. Since then, it has required only a few words, scrawled or screamed, to understand the fury of the nation's division over the war and civil rights. Stop the bombing. Make love, not war. Hell no, we won't go. Jim Crow must go. Burn, baby, burn. We shall overcome. The war over the war is fought by elders in government, but in the streets it is mostly confrontations between the young in combat boots and sandals. People tend not to separate warriors from the wars they are given to fight. Some are never forgotten. Some are never forgiven. Merely because they were the proxies of the best and the worst instincts and judgments of the societies that put them in the field. This is Edward Brown.
You're tuned to 1967 Summer of Love Station, 92.3 K-Rock, in stereo, WXRK, New York.
Your day breaks, your mind aches, you find that all linger on when she no longer needs you. She wakes up, she makes up,
She takes her time and doesn't feel she has to hurry. She no longer needs you, and in her eyes you see nothing. No sign of love behind the tears cried for no one. A love that should have lasted years. You want her, you need her, and yet you don't believe her when she says her love is dead. You think she needs you, and in her eyes you see nothing. No sign of love behind the tears cried for no one. A love that should have lasted years.
The Beatles, For No One. Jonathan Schwartz, 92.3 K-Rock, the evening of the 13th of August, 1967. Good evening.
There are places I remember all my life, though some have changed, some forever. That went before, I know I'll often stop and think about them. In my life, I love you.
Judy Collins at 92.3 K-Rock. In My Life. I'm in receipt of 20 packs of sweet, dark Mexican cigarettes called Faros. 3 cents for 16, I'm told. They are, in that sense, a bargain, but I really have no use for them. The illustration on the package, however, is queer and compelling. It shows, in orange and blue with a great deal of black hatching, a seacoast. The shipping lanes thereabouts must be hazardous. For not one, but three lighthouses are pictured, hence Faros, Spanish for lighthouses. One rises in the right foreground, partially cut off by the rectangle of rope with several fancy knots that frames the lurid and melancholy scene. Another lighthouse is situated on a small island in the middle ground, and the third is in the distance, near the horizon, and imperfectly described. Although the time is day, the sky is a screen of blue dots, while the sea is solid blue and consequently darker. The lights of the two nearest lighthouses are shining. The artist has portrayed the effulgent beams by a sequence of orange dashes, reminiscent, in a way, of the radiant gaze of Felix the cat. The far lighthouse and some rocks about it are obscured by a man's hat, and it is not clear whether the artist intended its light to be lit. Two steamboats are passing in the channels between the lighthouses, and there is an equivocal wind. Dark columns of smoke from the funnels of the inshore ship are billowing abaft, while the pennants on the masttops and a flag at the bow are blowing in the opposite direction. The shore is barren and rocky, perhaps volcanic, and the sea is rough. There are whitecaps beyond the middle lighthouse, and next to the shore, the turbulence is indicated by black smudges that represent waves or their shadows. The illustration may depict an actual view of the Mexican coast or elsewhere, but here I have no knowledge. The man in the hat stands in the left foreground, cut off at the back of the rope frame and at the waist by the word Cigarrera. In this respect, he is like a ruined bust recovered by divers from the sea, but he was never a hero or a statesman. He is in profile, and his face, which is colored a vivid orange as though he were looking into a furnace, is similar to one on a playing card. A sulky mouth and several stiff, romantic lashes radiating from a single, inflexible eye. He is facing the first lighthouse, but is staring beyond it, fashionably dressed in a jacket, a vest, a necktie, a white shirt, and a jaunty fedora with a turned-down brim. A small cigar or cigarette protrudes at right angles to his jaw from the center of his mouth, and he is touching with his left hand the brim of his hat. Is he about to tip it to someone, or is he merely holding it down against the wind? I would say that he is in his early 30s, my age, and years of indulgent sorrow. Is he the keeper of the first lighthouse? No, he is too elegant, and there is a softness to his round cheek. Is he rather a minor official who has the maintenance of all three lighthouses in his trust? The artist has made no connection between the man and his work, the way, for example, in English paintings of the 18th century, a keeper or stable boy handles or regards his dogs or horses. No. The man is a visitor to the coast, an idle and impatient resident of a large city near the lighthouses. He has often come out on Sundays to this headland to consider the sea and the shipping, the forces of tide and strong winds, the departure of ships, the gift and pledge of the horizon have acted upon him. Today he left forever his apartment. High ceilings, high blue mirrors that overlooked a square and an ornate fountain where water gushes from the astonished mouths of stone dolphins with the sound of adoration. His trunks are labeled and a taxi is waiting. He will sail upon the last tide. He knows he has wasted his life, flattered and shielded by women. His easy talents shedding light, like the lighthouses, on that which was already illuminated. Calling upon the coast for the last time, he faces the city and tips his hat in a salute of farewell. But this morning, he stood at the foot of my bed in the place of drowned men, hat in his hands. I saw him for a moment in the unendurable revelation of full face. He was older than I expected. Worn down, too, and full of regret. "What right do you have," he said bitterly, "to put yourself in my place?"
Go away from my window. Leave at your own chosen speed. I'm not the one you want, babe. I'm not the one you need. You say you're looking for someone who's never weak but always strong, to protect you and defend you, whether you are right or wrong. Someone to open each and every door, but it ain't me, babe. No, 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 it ain't me, babe. It ain't me you're looking for, babe.
On 92.3 K-Rock, on the night of the 13th of August, 1967, Bob Dylan, "It Ain't Me, Babe." This is Jonathan Schwartz.
The rag man draws circles up and down the black. I'd ask him what the matter was, but I know that he don't talk. And the ladies treat me kindly, and they furnish me with tea. But deep inside my heart, I know I can't escape. Oh, mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck inside a mobile with the Memphis Blues again. Well, Shakespeare, he's in the alley with his pointed shoes and his bells, speaking to some French girl who says she knows me well. And I would send a message to find out if she's talked. But the post office has been stolen and the mailbox is locked. Oh, mama, can this really be the end? Should be stuck inside a mobile with the Memphis Blues again. Now the tea preacher looks so baffled when I ask him why he dressed with 20 pounds of headlines stapled to his chest. But he cursed me when I proved to him. Then I whispered and said, not even you can hide. You see, you're just like me. I hope you're satisfied. Wow, mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck inside of Mobile with the Memphis Blues again. Now the rain man gave me two cures. Then he said, jump right in. The one was Texas medicine. The other was just railroad gin. And like a fool, I mixed them, and it strangled up my mind. And now people just get uglier, and I have no sense of time. Oh, mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck inside a mobile Memphis blues again. When Ruthie says, come see her in a honky-tonk lagoon, where I can watch her waltz for free neath the Panamanian moon. And I say, oh, come on now, you know about my debutante. And she says, your debutante just knows what you need, but I know what you want. Oh, mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck inside a mobile with the Memphis blues again. Now the bricks lay on Grand Street where the neon madmen clam. They all fall there so perfectly, it all seems so well timed. And here I sit so patiently, waiting to find out what price you have to pay to get out of going through all these things twice. Oh, mama, is this really the end? To be stuck here inside a mobile with the Memphis blues again.
On 92.3 K-Rock, on this Thursday evening, the 13th of August, 1967, Bob Dylan, stuck inside a mobile with a Memphis blues again. I love double record sets, and obviously we all know that this is one of them. Blonde on blonde. Just what it does is to perpetuate and encourage the theater of long-playing albums. You must remember, they're not very old, these long-playing albums. They just started about 15 years ago, in the event you were too young. But really, in the early 50s. And they were very slow, and so the first were very tentative. Just four songs on a side, 10-inch albums, they were small. I'm sure that somewhere in your house, your parents or somebody has a whole handful of these things, those 10-inch albums. And eventually the albums themselves made their debut onto the American and eventually international stage, the 12-inch albums. And through the late 50s, and of course in the 60s, we all know what happened to albums. They could be used, as I was talking earlier, as novels, really, and as pieces of theater, plays, with the beginning of Act One, the end of Act Two, then maybe if it's a three-act play or an O'Neill of some kind, the beginning of Act 12. And Blonde on Blonde is a marvelous example of how to program an album. Sergeant Pepper, that we just got 2 months ago, well, you know, early June, June 1st, June 2nd, is a classic example of an album that's programmed, that's sequenced brilliantly. It's not just a collection of songs. Everything works together. There was a great deal of thought that went into the programming of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And that will forever, along with what Dylan has been able to accomplish and some others, have an influence and a bearing on how creative albums affect us. Because it's the programming and the theatrics as well as the artwork that have a lot to do with it. In addition, of course, to what we fix on in the music. It just seems to me. You know, and this is probably very far-fetched, but someday somebody's going to invent some form of technology that eliminates that. You know, side one and side two. Oh, sure, the sound will be great, but there'll be no sides. Some kind of little square or triangle that you put into some machine, you'll be able to hear the sound, but there won't be an Act Two or an end of Act One. They'll just be the songs, sequenced to be sure, but the theater of it will be removed on behalf of the technology. And I'm sure that they will whittle away at the size, so it'll be down to the size of a cigarette pack. And so that what that will do will be to really to almost eliminate any artwork. Think of the cover, for example, of Sergeant Pepper that we've been staring at just now for 3 months or 2 months and we'll be staring at for the rest of our lives. Let's say that this technology, which is hypothetical and probably not for, you know, dozens and dozens of years, if not well into the next century, but that artwork would be so defined by its smallness, and it would be whittled down so that there'd be really no point in making such a cover, in putting in the effort, which eliminates a most important aspect of what albums are all about. Again, you know, I may be worrying in vain. It may be a silly thought, but it's a thought.
We'll be back with more great Summer of Love music in stereo on FM 92.3 K-Rock Radio.
Saturday night, August 15th, is this year's date for the 16th annual U.S. Diesel Truckin' Nationals. The day starts with a giant truck show all day long with all the big rigs, Mats, Peterbilt, Kenworth. They'll all be there racing and showing their stuff. Then at 7 o'clock, the Motorsports Spectacular starts with monster trucks, including Rambo, UFO, the Black Stallion, Liquidator, Timo Sabe, and more, racing and crushing down a quarter mile. Plus, Les Shockley's triple jet-powered Peterbilt will blow you away. Plus, wheelie cars, jet bunny cars and dragsters, and a human torch will attempt a flaming motorcycle stunt. You just gotta see to believe. That's Saturday night, August 15th. Then, Harley fans, Sunday, August 16th is your day. It's the Summer Harley-Davidson Festival. Hundreds of Harleys, from twin-engine top fuelers to low riders. 500 Harleys, plus vendors and a Harley swap meet. August 16th, all at Raceway Park near Englishtown, New Jersey.
Drag racing fans, Raceway Park is open every Wednesday for time trials or to make grudge runs against your buddy. Test your ride down the Raceway Park quarter mile now, and you only have to be 17 to race a streetcar in New Jersey. All you need is a helmet and a seatbelt, and you're ready.
A tasty fried cheese appetizer. No cheating now, there's plenty for two. Next, pick a pair of tempting meals from a choice of six, like chicken teriyaki, manicotti, our seafood platter, or chicken fried steak. Then share our decadent brownie bottom pie, only half the calories. Bennigan's Double Up Deal, our way of bringing more to the table for a lot less. So come see us soon. Just don't come alone, because there's big savings on dinner for two with a Double Up Deal. Only $18, only at Bennigan's. Tax not included. Offer ends September 5th.
Bennigan's brings more to the table than a great deal.
Octoon Baby. U2 Zoo TV Tour returns for a second and final New York night. Sunday, August 30th at Yankee Stadium, the final night with U2.
You were talking about the end of the world. Life with each other. Sisters. Brother.
Zoo UTV, where rock and roll, high tech, and trash collide. By overwhelming demand, a second night at Yankee Stadium. Sunday, August 30th, special guests Primus and Disposable Heroes of Hip-Hopercy. Tickets on sale this Saturday at 9 a.m. at Roseland Box Office, Ticketmaster and Ticketmaster Phone Charge. Produced by James L. Niederlander and Ron Telsner Enterprises. What's next? YouTube. The final night at Yankee Stadium.